Hi, everybody. John Suntress here with another edition of Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. Very happy today to bring back Scott Snyder. It has been too long, far too long, 5 years, something like that. I don't know. It was at the start of his Batman run, and it was after Detective, but it was early on the regular Batman title with Greg Capullo. But we revisit, talk about Detective Comics and his run with Jock and Francesco Francavilla. And we talk about his collaborations with Greg. It is the 75th anniversary of Batman. Endgame is going on currently, an amazing arc that is 2 issues in. And we talk about that. His excellent work on characters like the Joker and the Riddler. His thoughts on Batman himself. And not only that, we also talk some Good American Vampire conversation. And, of course, we talk about his new book from Image, Witches. And Witches is great. It's 2 issues in. Issue 2 comes out next week. And we give you a sample if you haven't already started reading it. It is a great Vertigo-style book. I think his fans of American Vampire will find it interesting. But I really do think that a lot of people would find Witches very, very interesting. Very novelistic. Something I've used to describe Matt Fraction and Jason Aaron's books as well. And I think Scott talks about writing the book in a very different style. But it's great conversation with Scott Snyder, very detailed. We talk about the differences of working for Vertigo and working with Image on a creator-owned book. And Scott is very candid about the similarities and differences of the two in today's comic book market and gives us an interesting observation of the comic book marketplace in general. Really happy to talk to Scott Snyder today about Word Balloon. And it's all brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you very much for your support, whether it's through PayPal or through patreon.com/wordballoon. Thank you. You help me get to conventions, update equipment, and make the connections with great creators that allow me to have more interesting conversations each week to bring you. So thank you to the League of Word Balloon listeners. And thank you to InStockTrades.com, our regular sponsor, who always has great deals waiting for you, sometimes 42% off, even more from the standard retail price. Shipping is free if it's over $50 on your orders. They can let you save up to 60% on select Marvel titles, select DC titles, 70% on select Dark Horse and IDW titles. And they make it easy with books on sale like Batman Superman Hardcover Volume 2, Game Over, 42% off. It's $14.49. From Robert Kirkman, you can get Invincible Trade Paperback Volume 20, 42% off. It's $9.85. Judge Dredd City Limits graphic novel, 30% off, $20.99. From Marvel, Original Sin, Thor and Loki, The Tenth Realm, 42% off, $9.85. You can get ACG's Collected Works, Forbidden Worlds, 25% off, $48.74. Roy Thomas presents Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, Volume 2, 25% off, $35.99. Those are just a few of the books that are waiting for you at great prices at InStockTrades.com. Go check it out for yourself. Okay, let's start our conversation with Scott Snyder. It is a pleasure to have Scott back on the show. It was so good. We immediately fell into conversation as soon as he picked up via Skype. And we start talking and we mention David at the beginning, and Scott is working with David. We're talking about David Hyde, a great PR guy that both of us knew from his days at DC and Warner Communications. And now David is an independent PR guy. He's the one who hooked Scott and I up to talk about Witches, Scott's new Image book that he's doing with Jock. And because we were dealing with a new collaboration with Scott and Jock, I wanted to start with a conversation about the Black Mirror as well. But David is David Hyde. That's who we're talking about at the beginning. So in case you don't know who we're talking about, I figured I'd give you that little bit of background. But as you can see, we couldn't start. And Scott couldn't wait. He immediately broke into stories. So you'll hear we kind of fall into it without a real official introduction to Scott. But very happy to have Scott Snyder back on Word Balloon.
Everything good?
Yeah, everything's fine. It's been a few years. You were on a long time ago on a DC call.
Yeah, wasn't it? It was like back when I was still on Detective Comics or something, I think, right?
I know we talked about Black Mirror.
Yeah.
I know we did. Which, yeah. Dude, I'm telling you, I mean, honestly, you're obviously kicking ass, and I'm very happy, and I've enjoyed everything. But I do go back to Black Mirror, and I'm going to say it in the interview as well. Really, it's still my favorite.
Oh, that's really okay. Well, I can deal with that. as long as it's by me, a favorite is fine.
There you go, man. Glad David's working out with you.
Oh yeah, dude, I love David. We go way back, man. In fact, my wife and I visited him and Dara in Brooklyn when I was first starting on Detective, and I told him the entire story for Black Mirror, walking around.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Star Slope. Yeah. He was like the first person I remember telling it to, the whole thing. So,
yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. We were walking around Park Slope and I was terrified. I remember being like, am I going over the line? Is it too much? Because there had been some resistance from DC at first about using James Jr. And then Dan DiDio had just come around on it and been like, listen, I know some people are not, you know, editorially are a little wary of it, but let's push it through. Let's do it. And I was like, okay. But of course, then I was terrified. I'm like, what if they all – I was nobody. And I was like, if there was resistance, maybe it sucks. And you know, I was like really scared. And I remember walking around Brooklyn with David, you know, the publicist now in Witches, who's, you know, an old friend, and his wife, and just telling him the story. And he was so supportive. He was just like, no, this is going to be great. And, you know, I'm really into it. Now you just got to get the right artist. And I remember being like, I'm going to get Jock, you know, I'm going to go to San Francisco and win him over. It's like the whole epic saga of it.
Well, all right. So yeah, I mean, how well did you know Jock at all? Or I mean, you know,
I didn't know him at all. And I was determined to win him over on this thing. And I knew he was busy. And so I went to San Diego, and that was really my whole purpose of going to San Diego that year, was to try and get him and Francesco to agree to do this book. And, I met him on, I think it was like the last day, it was like Sunday, or it was pretty late in the con. And, Mike Martz, the editor on Batman at the time, mm-hmm. had told me that if I got him to agree, I could use him. But, it was I don't want to say who said, I don't know if it's public, but there was a big artist on the book already, who's a great superhero artist. I love his stuff, and he's done some of my favorite stuff, but who cares, right? It was Mark Bagley, and I just adore him on Ultimate and everything. But for this particular story, I just didn't think it would work, and I'm dying to work with him. I think he's fantastic. But I was, you know, he was the person that was on Detective, and I'm not even sure if he had really signed on to do it thoroughly or so, you know, but I just asked, would it be possible to try and use someone else? And I can't even believe I asked that, because I was like, nobody, you know,
you know, I really want steak. This is a really excellent, you know, lobster thermidor that, you know, you've bathed in caviar, but I really want steak. So
it was like that. And
I can appreciate that, because, yeah, I mean, no, go on, tell the story.
Well, and so I met Jock, and I met him and he was like, let's go get a beer. So I went and got a beer with him and the colorist on the book, Dave Barron. And we were in this pub right in the Gaslight District, right across from the con. And I remember being like, if I don't keep up with him, he's going to think I'm a total pussy and he's not going to do the book. And so we were just drinking beer. And I remember feeling like by the end, a little bit sort of tipsy and being like, and finally Jock was sort of like, I told him the whole story and he was like, I'm in, let's do it. And I was like, yes. And I remember typing to Mike Martz, going back to my room and just being like, guess what, Mike Martz? I was like, Jock is in, you know, and then I was like, in, because I totally like fell asleep with my hand on the keyboard at that point, with my email on. So it was from a very humble beginnings that story came, but it was a great experience. I mean, that really was, you know, it was such a great introduction for me to Batman and to comics and all of it, just because, you know, it taught me so many different things, like about teamwork and also about how to write. Jock really helped me become a better writer. I mean, honestly, I was still super green at that time. I mean, I still feel green, but I was really green then. And I would be like, you know, he would walk me through sometimes, you know, why things would be better a different way. And I was always really up for whatever he wanted to do. And Francesco was similar, you know, teamwork also, you know, it was like, that was the first time, cause I was good friends with Raphael on American Vampire, but you know, American Vampire is creator owned. And so there isn't a lot of resistance to anything you want to do in a book that's creator owned. You just do whatever you want. Because no one can tell you they know the characters better. You're just like, no, I made it up. You know,
exactly. So yeah.
But with anything licensed, you know, there'll be editorial notes, and I'm always open. I mean, I love getting notes. I try to work with editors that are more hands on. I enjoy, you know, the back and forth, as long as I trust their story sense. I love that. And then that's why I've stayed with Mark, you know, Doyle from American Vampire to now. He's my, you know, I think one of the best editors in the business and one of my best friends. And the reason I would have him edit the books, even if I hated him. I mean, just cause he's so good at it. But I love him. But, like for example, for me, actually the editor on Witches is a friend, David Brothers, who works at Image, and he was actually the first person to really criticize me publicly, when I first started. No, he was. He was.
He's criticized me. Feel free, go on.
Oh yeah, no, he wrote a long thing about how I started a lot of stories the same way with this first person narration that was really nostalgic, and I hadn't realized it, but I had. I had started like Black Mirror that way, and I had started Batman and Swamp Thing that way, and he pointed it out, and he was just like, you know, well, let's hope he doesn't rely on this or whatever. And I remember writing to him and just being like, dude, you're totally right. I appreciate you pointing it out and criticizing me. And, you know, when he was at Image, so I hired him, he's the editor on Witches, you know, now. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
I like when it's construct, when someone says something constructive and critical, I'm all about it. So I don't have any trouble, but what I was saying about being a team is like, you know, working in licensed comics, wherever you are, I'm sure not just DC, but at Marvel too, because I hear, you know, stories there too. But you will sometimes get notes that you just blatantly disagree with, you know, and sometimes things that you think will compromise the integrity of the story. And in those cases, it's really important to have your team together, because when Greg, for example, Batman, like he's like my brother, you know, Greg and I are, we've become like best friends. I mean, that guy is like, you know, my big brother. And my feeling is, when he's unhappy with something, I'm right behind him. And if I'm unhappy with something, you know, he's right behind me. And for example, like when we did the issue in Batman where it turned, you know,
yes, the upside down. Yeah.
Issue 5. Right. He suggested that after I gave him some sort of like note that was like, well, we got to find the craziest thing to do with this page and maybe do like fractured panels or anything, a maze. And he was just like, what if we turn the whole book? And I was like, yes. He wrote this email and they were like, no, it's going to look like a misprint. And he wrote this impassioned email that was great. It was like, sometimes you have to be foolish in life and you have to, you know, and I was just like in the background being like, yeah, yeah, man. Yeah. You know, I was like writing like emails, like, you know, like just sort of, you know, like what he said, you know, and then, and then they finally came around because we were both like, if you don't let us do this, we're both going to be so disappointed. It's going to kill our enthusiasm on this book, you know, and they let us do it. And the funniest part of the story is like, then we got the PDF for that issue and it reads vertically as a PDF. So I'm reading it and I'm like, those pussies, look at it. It's not that jarring. It just goes around in a circle. It just goes around in a circle. So what? You know, and then I got the comps and the physical copies and I saw it and I was like, holy shit, there's a misprint in this thing. And I was like, the whole book is crazy. And I was like, oh God, wait, that's what we wanted. And I tweeted out, I was like, just so you guys know, everything in Batman 5 is deliberate. And Greg called me up and he was like, what are you doing, man? If they don't get it, they don't get it. Like, you know, take that down. And I was like, okay. So I took it down. And then the funniest part is like 20 minutes later, I see him tweet, there's a goddamn misprint in Batman 5. And I called him up and I was like, yo, it's not a misprint. That's what I was saying. And he was like, oh, okay. I was like, take that down. And he took that down. And then we were cool. But we hadn't realized that you'd really be reading the book almost backwards and upside down at one point. And, you know, so kudos to DC for doing it. And yeah, we both fell for our own gimmick. But you know, with Jock, yeah. Well, I would just say like, yeah. And what I would say is the lesson to me and all of that is that you got to be a team. Like it does not work on a book. And I've worked with artists occasionally where, you know, on very small things, but where, and not anymore, where we just didn't really connect or we didn't fight. I just mean, it wasn't, they were just in a different space and it wasn't, mm-hmm. you just didn't communicate. They didn't want to communicate. They just wanted the script. And sure. In that way, that's just my least favorite way to work. And I just think for me, I like, you know, getting to know the person and being friends, you know, sharing, and you're a team. And then once something comes down the pipe, that's like, no, you can't do this. Or we want you to stick this in the book. And you're like, listen, we're going to have to lock arms on this thing and chain ourselves to the book. You know what I mean? And you're sort of like, that's happened a number of times on, you know, it's over the years with different teams on different books, you know, and that it's really, I just think it's really key because you have to be super flexible and you have to really adapt to notes and listen to them. And I'm very, you know, very open to that stuff. But sometimes there will be a note that comes from a place that isn't story based, but is more of a corporate, you know, concern. And sometimes those concerns, you have to get in lockstep together and say, you know, we got to stand up to this one. And if it, sometimes you lose and that's okay. And sometimes you don't, but having your team with you means everything, you know?
Understood. Well, you say that, Francesco and Jock, you know, taught you, you know, how to write better. Is that in terms of communicating better to the artist to achieve this kind of teamwork?
Both things. I mean, the two things I'd say they taught me were one, just actual literal storytelling better on the page where
okay.
I still was putting too many panels, I think, a lot of the time. And I didn't, mm-hmm. I would put a lot of dialogue in a panel that had action in it too. Things like that, that I just wasn't thinking about. I was more prosaic in my mind and I just didn't.
Okay.
I wasn't.
Makes
wasn't
sense thinking, coming from.
Yeah. I just didn't see some things need to be more kinetic. And,
okay. Okay.
The second thing is just what you're saying where it was more about communicating and feeling artists out. So, what I learned was like some write differently for different artists and bring their strengths mm-hmm. out. So for me, I really understood that when we hit issue, I think it was 873. It was like our third issue, I think. It was our fourth issue. And it was Francesco, I was telling him about this diner scene where Jim was going to meet with James Jr. and they were going to talk. Mm-hmm. And the whole scene was going to be a conversation with this creepy thing in the background with the water coming out from under the thing. And he was like, yeah, like Hitchcock. And I was like, exactly. So I'm going to panel it. And I started paneling it like really tightly. And, you know, and he was like, well, I get it. Like, why don't you just write the dialogue and let me work on it. And I was like, okay, I guess, you know, but I felt badly because I was like, you're doing my job. Like I'm getting paid for what you're doing, dude. I feel terrible, you know, but he's like, no, I enjoy this. And so I kind of let it, I just did the dialogue and I, you know, talked about the feeling of the scene and let him do it. And he just killed it. And I was like,
oh yeah.
I was just like, you know what? I get it. You know, like, and so then I started asking more and being like to Jock, you know, are there things you want me to give you more room where you really can, you want to make things up? And Jock is a little different. He likes the comfort of full script. And then he'll go off the script when I tell him like, please go off the script, do whatever you want, you know?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But, he enjoys having the whole thing, which I love too. Whereas Greg, for example, Greg likes it as loose as possible, as loose, mm-hmm. as loose as I can make it. Greg enjoys it. So the scripts look very different for Raphael, for Greg, for Jock, you know, and for Jim Lee. Like all of them are very different. And I try to make sure that the important things about each issue, tonally, emotionally, psychologically, those things are described this exact same way for each artist. I mean, I never shorten that stuff. But for some people like Rafa really likes making, mm-hmm. he really loves making up action, but he's not quite as fond, I think, of making up the dialogue scene paneling. So he enjoys that panel, but he likes room for action. Greg actually really likes, he doesn't mind, he likes doing the acting for dialogue scenes and action. He likes a few beats, but he likes to be able to choreograph how many pages it takes. So I put in the beats of how it's going to happen and then let him decide how to expand or compress. And, you know, so there, it's, that's what I mean. It's like, I really learned on that book to communicate, but also to, A, how to just be a better writer. B, I think how to communicate. And C, most importantly, how to let the thing be a living collaboration that sort of exists uniquely between you and that collaborator, and don't try and do what you do with a different artist with this artist, you know, play to their strengths. So ask them what they want to do, you know, like the truth is like, so there's a scene in Witches, right? In Witches number two. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For example, cause I just was looking at it and I love it. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad this is what we did. But the thing, it's basically if you're not reading Witches, it's, you know, this horror book I'm doing at Image with Jock. And,
yep.
And yeah, I know, you know. But I'm,
yeah, do the 10-cent thing for the people. This
I will.
Is crazy.
In case you're not reading it, it's basically, it's this horror book I'm doing at Image, which I'm very proud of, with Jock and Matt Hollingsworth and Clem Robbins, the amazing letterer who's like the unsung hero of the book. And
agreed.
And, He's so good. And what I would say is that it's basically, it reimagines the idea that it imagines witches instead of being like, you know, old green hags with hats, as like these very primal, ancient, bestial, cannibalistic sort of humanoid creatures that live very deep in the woods. And
kind of druidy, would you say?
Yeah, well, they're sort of naked and cannibalistic and tall and skeletal. And so they're just, yes. they're really scary. And they have their eyes on the side of their head so that they can kind of peek around trees and catch you. And they're really scary looking. I know, they're super gross. But they, you know, and they only come after you if you've been pledged to them. They have a strange kind of animal behavior, like culture, where that means if somebody wants something from them, and they have this incredible knowledge of their own private ancient science. That's why people think witches have spells. But it's not magic. It's actually an organic science. They don't talk, and they're very alien to us. Like, they don't wear clothes, and they're very, you know, primal. But at the same time, they're able to make tinctures and grinds and bone mixtures and things that will basically cure things that modern medicine can't. And they can make people fall in love with you, make you forget things you don't want to remember, add years to your life. And so, you know, imagine your kid is sick, you know, badly sick, and your neighbor is kind of an old asshole. Well, you know, you might want to like go over there, have a pie with them, and, you know, touch them with the scent that you marks them for the witches, and the witches will come drag them off and eat them in the woods, and in return give you a little packet, you know, a little thing in wrapped in skin that you give your kid, and will heal, you know, whatever terminal illness your kid has. So that's sort of the basis of the book, and I really love it. And it's basically it focuses the first arc on this one family that moves to New Hampshire to escape this kind of traumatic thing. And anyway, the point is, it's about a father, mother, and daughter, and the daughter is 13, and she was terribly bullied, and she kind of the bully that was after her disappeared into the trees while she was bullying her, and she believes it was these creatures, and no one believes her, and they think that she might have killed her or something like that, but there was never any evidence. So these rumors follow her. So anyway, it was the longest like corn maze of a setup for anything ever. But so what happens is, in the second issue, she's having visions of she's seeing the girl, the bully that attacked her, who disappeared, and she's seeing her back from the dead, basically coming for her, and she doesn't know if it's real or not. And I was doing a scene, and I'm like, she's finally making a friend or two, and then all of a sudden she sees this girl in the cafeteria across the way, and she's like, you know, freaks out. And and at the same time, she's got this lump on her neck that the girl gave her when she bit her. And so I wrote this whole scene in the cafeteria, and I was like, you know, showing it to Jock, and I was talking about it, and he's like, no, it's great, let's do it. And he was like, you know, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, I'm thinking about his art and thinking about cafeteria, and I'm like, he does these moody, eerie scenes so well, right? Like, he's so good with flat color, flat backgrounds, that he can make very stark things look very loaded with menace. And so I was like, well, instead of setting it in the cafeteria, I'll make a gym class, and they're in the pool. They're going swimming. And then it'll be all the girls lined up in similar swimsuits. And I know he can make that creepy. And he just, you know, because it's all the black swimsuits and the white caps. He can make anything creepy. So
absolutely. No, I saw the scene, and yeah, exactly, man. It is. Yeah. It's
And so I put it there, and I was like, and then all these other ideas came, because I was like, oh, she's under the water. The bandage will come off her lump, and she'll feel this thing. And like, I was just like, oh, it's perfect. And you know, for him. And I did it. And it's the exact same scene emotionally. What I mean is, it was the same beats in a cafeteria that happened in the pool. But in somebody else's hands, like Greg would probably actually do better in the cafeteria, because he loves the acting of characters. And he makes it so vibrant when you see many characters in the background. But Jock does so well with these incredibly pared down sorts of scenes, you know, where it's a person, a background that's really stark. He creates such an emotional kind of like almost vibrating with emotion kind of or ominous feeling or tone kind of panel that I just thought a pool was so much better. And that's what I mean. That's a small example, but it matters to me in the way that I just did it. It was, you know, and that's you write, just if you're an aspiring writer, try and think of what your artist likes to do, what they're good at, what will make them excited to go to work, and don't be so attached to the, you know, the particulars of a scene that you, and realize if you, you know, the kind that if you actually step back from, you realize don't matter that much, because the emotional stuff, the beats where the scene goes is what's important. The context of it is, you know, artist to artist, what you think they're going to sing on. So anyway.
I understood. And honestly, people that have read the first issue and will read the second issue will see exactly what you're talking about. This is great. This is much. This is your DVD commentary for Witches. I like it. Yeah. No, honestly, I see exactly what you're talking about, because you and David were kind enough to also give me issue two.
Yeah.
And no, I appreciate it, man. I find it interesting, and you've actually helped underline a couple of the questions I already had prepared. You say the very serious notes that David gave you in the past about your stories, and I really felt that you've opened this story in a very novelistic way.
Yeah, this one is definitely a new kind of writing for me, where it's much more sort of prosaic, I think, in certain ways, or more novelistic, where it's more slow burn and it's more character driven, I think, from go. And the high concept of the whole thing takes a long time to, not long, but it doesn't really come in until issue. The monsters come in issue two, but you don't even learn about them really till issue, you know, four, in terms of what they are. You know what I mean? Okay.
But I like that, and I am interested from a bigger picture standpoint, because I was just saying this last time I had him on. I said this to Fraction about Satellite Sam. I like that. I think that's great that a lot of you guys, when you're doing your creator-owned stuff, are real. Well, you know, I imagine that at this point, at your and the same with Fraction, you guys have an audience that not only obviously Batman, but what you've done with American Vampire and stuff. Jason Aaron, I was saying the same thing too. Mm-hmm. That, you know, your guys' audience, you guys, they know what to expect, and they are coming on and saying, "I am taking the journey with you." And I'm glad that you're telling your story and letting it breathe. And, you know, because there's for mainstream books, as you were just saying about some of the things corporate will let you do and won't do, there really is this imperative to give people their $3.99 worth, or sometimes $4.99. I'm really glad you stepped in on that with Batman.
Thank you.
But you know what I'm saying in terms of that, you know, episodically, you know, hey, you got to make sure that the, you know, everyone understands what's going on, and really, you know, and I don't mean, I don't mean to say that Witches is confusing, but
no,
then
no, it's different muscles, with these, dude. It's,
yeah, and I, also different, yeah, different places that the plot is coming from that eventually will converge. But yeah, talk about this new writing that you're trying to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, with Batman, the thing is, you know, I am, there's certain muscles you flex where it feels like I love to do. Sorry, I'm getting over this cold. My kids have brought back from school. It's like Petri dishes. These two kids.
It's true. Yeah, exactly. Welcome back, kids. True.
I try and make sure that every issue of Batman has a certain, like a few kinds of things in it. Like, it always has some kind of action with Batman being badass, because that's Batman. I always try and really give, you know, push the deeper plot forward, obviously, in some way, mm-hmm. you know, mechanically and to quick those wheels. But I also try and do something that pushes, more importantly, the emotional arc forward, and, you know, a few steps. And then I try and let myself surprise myself with how I'm going to frame it, or how I'm going to structure the issue best for what it's about, how I'm going to try and create themes beneath the surface. And I let myself play in that regard. But there's certain kind of boulders that are going to be there, meaning I know that I need certain things to make it feel, for me as a Batman reader, that it's a good Batman comic. And with Witches, or with, you know, Witches is different, because American Vampire, I use some of those same muscles. American Vampire, because it was my first series too, I always designed it. I mean, I like things that are bombastic. It is just the way I am. I'm wired. Like, I love, my favorite shows are Breaking Bad and The Americans, and shows that have very sort of big plots and high concepts that move forward that are ultimately character driven, you know, much more so than the plot. That's what I like. But I don't, more so than, like, for example, I really like Mad Men. I love watching it, but I lean towards Breaking Bad over Mad Men. Or I love The Sopranos, but again, I lean towards, like, you know, The Wire or that. I like the more designed plot, sort of bigger. I'm more than a conceptual or more meandering, in a fun way, meandering, exploratory kinds of stories. It doesn't mean I don't like those. There are plenty I love. I just, my sweet spot, it exists on that, I think, on that graph. It's plotted right at the point where it's like biggest action and biggest horror and also biggest character stuff. And it just is what it, where I exist, for better or worse, you know, and that's, I understand that. So something like Witches for me, or The Wake, I'm trying to flex really different muscles, because American Vampire is high drama. It's very soapy in the way that I love. And it's very, you know, high action, high horror, high drama. I wanted to do something with this that showed, you know, challenged me to be just really, really blackly scary and just go very personal and very emotional and go back to some of the stuff I did in prose where it's really, you know, mining certain things out of characters that are terrifying for them, you know, in that way where it's really just a totally different kind of storytelling for me where, you know, it still has moments. I know that I need a couple scares every issue, you know, and that kind of thing. I'm not going to, you know, it has things it needs, but for the most part, my goal issue to issue is to just make the series feel really immersive character wise, slowly more and more unsettling, you know, scary, but not in an over the top way, just scary in a way that you start to sense that you, the characters that you love might be the people bringing about the horror because of secret desires and stuff like that. And that, that terrible feeling of paranoia that comes with that. That's, it's a different kind of writing for me. You know, it's really, I'm really like The Wake for me was all about, you know, exploring and adventure, and it was bright and, you know, humorous and crazy. This is sort of like, you know, let's get really, really cruel and mean and be as tough on yourself as you can as a writer. So
interesting. Well, and I think Jock is, as you're writing this very novelistic approach, I think Jock in a lot of his scenes, there's a lot of film kind of feel to it. The pool scene that you mentioned, for example, and also a lot of the scenes in a different way, in the woods, they really have that, you know, I mean, that's a great place. And again, it's Jock's obviously the right man for this book. And I mean, go on and from that.
Yeah. Well, he was the only person I ever asked to do it from the moment I thought of it. It was like, you know, and I thought of it, it was about a year and a half ago, and it was up in Pennsylvania. I was like at the lake house. I wrote about it in the back of issue one, but it was, I wrote a little essay that's there in the back of issue one about it. But it's, my parents have had this lake house there since I was a little kid, and I was out there, and I just, and I thought of it. I remember being like, there's only one person to draw this, and that's Jock. And I wrote him, and he was like, yeah, I have a few months and then I'll be free. And can you wait? And I was like, of course I'm going to wait. Like, let's do it. And his art is so perfect for it, because the two things that I think it does for the series really well is I'm actually pushing the story forward. It feels slow, you know, because it's not slow, but it feels very, I think, spacious in terms of the character moments.
Absolutely, yes.
But the plot actually moves forward quite fast if you look at issue to issue. And Jock's art does such a good job of masking that in the way that it, he's so good at making it feel emotional and character-driven. And it is that way, but I'm saying it also doesn't feel rushed. It feels open and creepy and spacious. And the second thing is he's so good at scares, and the sense of not big, you know, he's great at scares, like the moment that it's really scary, but he's also great just at the slightest things he does, these thoughtful little things like tilting a panel a certain way, getting a little too close or too far from a character, these things, you know, the angle he chooses. It's this very thoughtful kind of horror that I knew was perfect for the book, that I think it just, he just kills it, you know, where he's just so unsettling in just the right way, where you feel discomfort, but it's a good kind of spooky discomfort. And then I have to also say Matt Hollingsworth, that guy is just out of control, amazing. I mean, I worked with him on The Wake also, and his style is just radically different on this book than it was on that. That's what I really, I don't know, I just respond to that stuff so well. I mean, like that, I love the elasticity in certain creators, like, you know, like Matt just trying a brand new color style on this. And what I'm saying about the writing in this, and then I'll shut up, is just I'm trying. Though I hope what people see, and I like, I'll just be blunt. Jason Aaron is like my favorite over at Marble. Like I love so many people over there. Like I admire, I mean, Brian Bendis is also like an idol, and you know what Matt's been able to do with Hawkeye, I just think is masterful and incredible. And with his own series. But the thing I love about Jason, you know, and I mean, there's so many good people, and Jonathan, I mean, you know, Manhattan Projects is one of my favorite books on the stand. So this is, but the thing I think is about Jason is that, everything I read, I know it's Jason's book when I start Thor. I can tell it's him because of the sensibility, the way, the kind of themes that he constructs, you know, about coming to grips with lies about yourself in some way, that those things are there in Scalped. They're there in Southern Bastards, you know, even about Wolverine and the X-Men, coming to terms with who you really are. All the things that I know Jason deals with, you know, and location. Coming home, these themes, but the books are so wildly different, and so there's such an elasticity to his writing, where he's able to he challenges himself book to book to do such different things, and it's like from Scalped to Wolverine and the X-Men to Southern Bastards to Men of Wrath. These books are so different from one another, and Thor. And yet each one is clearly a Jason book, and they're all great. And that to me is like, with Witches and with Wake and with Zero Year being what it was versus what Joker was versus what Black Mirror was, the one thing I do hope is that people at least see that that's what – I'm trying my best to do that and trying my best to be like – you know, each story is something that's very different than the last thing, so that I don't, for myself, it's not for anybody else. I mean, it's for, I love writers that do that. And that's, I'm trying to be one of those guys hard. And which is for me, I'm deeply proud of it because it's this thing I wanted to try for a long time, the kind of horror that I love, like the very, very dark personal horror, but I haven't had that opportunity. And this is that for me.
That's excellent, man, and I'll tell you, I really loved your Swamp Thing and what you did over there. And again, that's, you know, mainstream, but you know, it had that horror tinge to it. But yes, I would say that this is like the horror story that I think people suspected you might be able to do, and I'm glad that you're doing it, and I'm glad that you're doing it on your own terms as well, and that you've got these people that you're stretching because. Not only, and I'm glad you mentioned Matt, because I want to go back to Clem and also understand if Jock is the guy, because you've got this meta story going on. I don't know how much longer, if it's going to continue, you'll tell us, but this children's story that's going on as well. And, you know, is Jock doing the kind of storybook stuff we saw at the beginning of two? And,
yeah, he's doing that too. Yeah.
So he's, okay, and again, Clem and Matt as well. You go ahead and describe it. I'll just say it's this children's story. It adds to the creepiness in the way that some of the brightly sunny lit scenes of The Shining, there's still this feeling of, you know, something disturbed. And it's a great contrast too of what else is going on in the book. And God, hats off to all of you.
Thanks. I mean, that's one of my favorite things in the book is the sense of, you know, of I want it to feel surprising when you open it each time. And I want it to be like, you never know what's coming when you turn the page, and that sense of, you know, it's a very thematic book in some ways. So the book is is really very much about, not to spoil it, but I mean, and I won't, I mean, plot wise, this won't spoil it, but it's about the terror of being a parent. You know, it's about the fact that you cannot protect your children from things in the world as much as you want to. And you tell them that there aren't monsters, and you tell them that there aren't, you know, things under the bed, and there aren't. But the thing that there is, there's human cruelty, there's terrible, you know, this terrible careless behavior. There are things that could do horrifying things to them any day at any moment. And what the witches are, they're, for me, that's so scary is that they only come after you if somebody does, if pledges you. And so they're a twisted reflection of the worst parts of ourselves. They only respond to our own desires that way. And so it's about, you know, not being able to protecting your child from kid fears. But what if those kid fears are really just reflective of the worst parts of human nature? You can't protect your child from that. And people, you know, out there in the world, you know, are going to do terrible things. And, you know, you just pray it doesn't happen to your kid. And so that's what powers the first arc, at least. It, you know, the second arc is more about the witch hunters and things like that. But the first arc really is, you know, it's deeply personal in that regard. It's that sense of the guilt and terror of, am I doing a good enough job at this? Is there something wrong? The deep desire once in a while to have a break from it, to think, I wish I didn't worry about my kids as much. And, you know, someone, a monster, hearing that and saying, well, then let me take them away. You know, that kind of sense of all of those things wrapped up in the story that makes it scary to me personally. That's what it's about, you know? And so I hope that comes through, you know, too, in some way. But the fun is, it's, I want it to be something that, with the children's story, for example, the main character is a graphic novelist. And, you know, he has a successful series that's about a kid whose grandfather owns an amusement park, a closed down amusement park. And at night, mm-hmm. the place comes alive and it has all this magic to it. And so the kid explores different rides, and each ride opens into a different version of reality. And so this story that he's working on now is the second in the series, and it's about the Hall of Mirrors. And so in the series itself, and in this world of mirrors, the kids, if you wish for something, you just get it with no hard work or anything. It just appears. And so the story is just a kid's story, and it kind of comes in and out of things. But if you look, like, you know, the witches themselves, they respond. That's what they do. You go out there and you wish for things you shouldn't have that are unnatural, and you get them. You extend your life. You bring somebody back, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so for me, it's one thing in the book that's also – it's meant to be – a twisted sort of reflection of what's going on, and you'll see it come into play in scarier ways later on in the book.
That's cool, man. No, it's neat. And again, you're putting Matt and Jack and Clem through their faces. And that's why, like, it's not your average lettering job when you have to incorporate this stuff in there as well.
Yeah. And Clem's awesome, by the way. He's so funny. I love him. Like, we just became friends on the book, and I'm like, you lettered Preacher. You know what I mean? He's just like, he's all like, he's very funny. He's like, he's super down to earth and hilarious. I really like Clem a ton.
That's excellent. That's very cool. So first arc, 5 issues? Or
it's going to be six. It was going to be 5, but the 5th was going to be oversized. And then we decided, you know what, instead of taking a month off and then doing a giant 5 that's going to be more expensive, just do 2 issues. So it's going to be 6 issues.
Okay. What was the choosing Image at this point and everything? Was it just, you know, this is the right time? I mean, how do you see the market right now?
Yeah, and the market is fascinating to me right now, where – it's probably the best time to be a comic writer ever, I think. You know, I feel like this Mr. Magoo that, like, wandered in at, like, the best time ever. But the truth is, I mean, the creator-owned market is just so vibrant right now. And it's thanks to everybody listening, like, the fact that there's readership all of a sudden for these books that are basically, you know, pet projects for people that are passion projects, really. I mean, that wasn't there even 5 years ago, you know, the same way, or 6 years ago at all. I mean, it wasn't nearly the way it is now. And that, so for me, it was a few years, I did a book at Image actually a few years ago called Severed with my friend.
Yes.
Similar kind of horror to this, but this is a little more personal to me than that one. That was a little bit more, it was more academic. I love that book, but it was also about America. It was about this moment in American history, I mean, that I was always loved. I always loved the early 1900s when there was this burst of inventiveness, where there was sort of, you know, the airplanes and the car was becoming popular, and, you know, there was electric lighting and all these wonders all of a sudden, you know, the telephone and all of these things that were revolutionizing the way we live and creating all these possibilities. And yet there was this, like, this World War One, and these, you know, all the horrors of the 20th century were just becoming clear too. And so that book is very much about that. It's about a boy who runs away because he was trying to find his father, who's a traveling minstrel, a blackface performer. And he's very optimistic. And It's about a guy who might or might not be the supernatural sort of demon of the road who eats children who go off and try and follow their dreams. So I did do a book at Image that I'm really happy with, but it was also I did it with my friend, Scott Tuft, who I co-wrote it with, and I was busy with DC stuff, and, you know, Image was a little bit different back then too, where it was still great, but it's just grown so much from that. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit more for us to do, I think, then than there is now on the book. There's more of support from Image in terms of, you know, editorial and publicity and the kinds of things that I think they're doing a terrific job of putting in place, you know, and have in place mm-hmm. now. So anyway, you know, it was about a year, 2 years ago, and almost it was two San Diegos ago. So it was 2 years ago. And and I met with Eric Stevenson and Robert Kirkman, and I was just like, I have this carve out in my contract. It was a year July, so it was, you know, whatever, a year and a few months. And I mm-hmm. said, I really want to do something with you guys. I feel like I love working at DC and I love Vertigo, but, you know, even at Vertigo, DC or Warner Brothers owns the property for a bit before it reverts to you. If you're able to get kind mm-hmm. of a reversion deal, it's still with them for a bit. And I wanted to try it again and be like, what if I did something that was totally mine and I owned from go, and I wanted to challenge myself to put the book together and to work on it with, you know, Jock, and to know that it was going to be an artist. I didn't know it was going to be Witches at that moment, and do something that would be ours. And so I was talking to Eric, and I remember we're upstairs in this restaurant, and Robert Kirkman walks in and he's there. And we've, you know, we're friendly at that time. Now we're closer. I consider him a friend, but we, he sits down, and I'm kind of nervous, and I'm like, well, I've got like three or four ideas, you know, and whichever one that you guys want, you know, to do, cause I know you might have, if you already have a horror book or you already have a sci-fi book, I can do any one of them, you know. And I pitched these whole series of ideas, all of which I want to do, by the way. So I'm going to be doing another one soon, actually. So
excellent.
Yeah. I'm excited about the next one too, but it'll be announced pretty soon, but
okay, cool.
And he goes, so I pitched him all this stuff, and Eric goes, he's like, I was like, so which one do you guys want out of those? You know, which fits the slate best? And he was sort of like confused, and he's like, whichever one you want to do. And the funniest thing was, like, it was really sort of a transformative moment for me with Image, in the way that, because it's true, you know, in most publishers you think, well, do you have enough sci-fi, or do you have too much horror? Do you have, where does this fit? You know, and the fact that what I realized is what he wants Image's sort of genre to be, or what he wants their selling point to be, is that regardless of genre, regardless of commercial, you know, prospects or any of it, the creators come to Image to do the book they want to do the most. And that's his sort of pitch. And it was really refreshing. And DC has been wonderful to me. I mean, Vertigo lets me, you know, there wasn't any moment where I pitched something to Vertigo and they said, no, we want something else. But it's just, there's a different machinery there. It's super, it's very supportive. But it's also, the thing for me, I guess, what it boiled down to, if I could, you know, the sort of core reason was because even working for Vertigo, it's still DC, and I go to work at DC for Batman and for American Vampire. And for me, it was almost like the way I explained it to them, because they were great about giving me room. I can do stuff wherever I want that isn't Marvel, basically, in my contract.
Okay.
You know, so
that makes sense. It's just funny to hear it. Go on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's the way it is. So the thing for me is that, you know, I was explaining to them, because I was like, I just want to give you a heads up. I'm going to be doing this thing at Image. I don't want you to feel offended that I'm not doing it at Vertigo. I already have The Wake at Vertigo, and I already have American Vampire at Vertigo. And, it's basically like I go to work. It's like going to work in the city or something, and you go to work to the same place all the time, and you love going to work in that place. But you know what would be nice? Like having a country house or a house like outside the city where you go and you're working there for a change for a week or, you know, for the summer or something, because you're used to coming into this place you love and all the same people are in the office and all the same, you know what I'm saying? So for me, it's like publicity for The Wake is the same people I do publicity with for Batman is the same. And I love them. I'm very good friends with them, Pamela and, you know, like friends outside of DC. Cool. But it's fun to try something different. You know what I'm saying? That's what I mean about trying new books. Like, I mean, new ways of writing. It's like, it gets familiar. And when it gets familiar, it gets stale. You know, and that's...
Understood.
So for me, it was the right time to go to Image. I love Image. You know, I'm really happy doing stuff with them. And I'd like to, honestly, for a second, also just say that I hope people also know Vertigo is a terrific... It really is a terrific place to be. And... You know, I have a lot of love for them, and I really do hope to do more stuff with them in the future too. I mean, I really, really love the people that work there, and having that whole machinery behind you, the support, all that stuff is a great thing too. So, you know, it's not really a matter of sort of leaving one for the other for me. It's more you're flexing different muscles and there are different challenges.
Understood. And what perspective can you share with us in terms of how Vertigo's changed now post Karen Berger and, you know, some of the others that have left?
Well, I think, I mean, post Karen, I don't know. Cause Karen, you know, for me, I'm friendly with Karen, and my feeling was what she started is still going there in a lot of ways, like projects that I know she was, you know, so, and Shelley and she were so close that, you know, my feeling is that, I haven't seen it change radically, but what I can say is I know for a fact that Vertigo, they've made a very big push to try and make it so that their contracts are going to be more, I think, more flexible and more amenable, like in terms of the kinds of stuff that, you know, people gravitate towards Image for in some ways, where you own your stuff outright. I mean, Warner Brothers isn't capable of really doing that, you know, off the bat, because part of the reason they do the stuff is so that you have a chance to have it come out at Warner Brothers.
Sure.
So what I would say is, and I don't know if I'm talking too off the cuff, but there's a great thing to that, meaning it's a great feeling to know that you have something that Warner Brothers is looking at and considering seriously to do something with, because it's this massive, production house.
Right. With a lot of platforms to, you know, I hate using the word exploit, but you know what I mean? No. That in the best possible way, that you take a story idea and are able to present it after its successful comic book on these other platforms. We're at an interesting point right now. And that's why Disney and Warner Brothers are, you know, allowing interesting things to happen. Gotham's a great show. Constantine, I haven't had a chance to watch yet. I'm certainly curious, but everything that's in the pipeline right now, both film, I mean, we just heard Warner Brothers slate. We heard Marvel's as we're recording today, Marvel made their big announcements and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's I appreciate what you're saying, and I agree that, you know, it's advantageous to have them behind you, but I can appreciate, and you go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say that I think the only thing that was difficult with American Vampire, that stuff, is that when I was coming up, the deal was more, you know, they own it in sort of perpetuity, you know, and I was happy to do that because I was brand new, and to get to do something with Vertigo at that point was a dream. You know, now when you're a more established creator, I think, you know, you lean into the idea of something like Image if you can sell the books in some way because you own the rights, and it seems like a golden ring. But what I'd say is owning the rights is wonderful, but Warner Brothers owning the rights is also wonderful, and it's just a decision for different creators to make on their own. I mean, the thing I would say about the way Vertigo has changed, going back to your question, is that
yes,
I know that they're also – they're really starting – they've always loved Vertigo and it was always a priority. But I also know that they're really focusing on it now in a great way, where it's – as they move to the West Coast and the whole company uproots, they're looking to Vertigo to really be something special to Warner Brothers in terms of books that they're going to do that do have a lot of potential for all kinds of different sort of platforms, you know, and that doesn't mean they're going to be more movie-like or TV-like. I mean, I just know there's going to be a big there's going to be a brighter spotlight on those books because they're right there all of a sudden under on the Warner Brothers lot, you know, and that. So they are looking to sort of reshape some of their contracts and that stuff to be more, I think, you know, more inviting. And they do already have those contracts is what I would say. I mean, I have a good contract on The Wake where, you know, I'm very happy with it. And there's, okay, you know, so I don't know how much is, you know, out of school to say. So I don't want to. I mean, I don't want to talk contract stuff, but
No. Honestly, I was, and I appreciate your honesty in terms of how, as an individual creator, you're just assessing things. But also, I think the fear that readers had, especially with Karen leaving, was just this good judicial creative eye that appreciated original ideas and made Vertigo what it was. Really, you know, Karen was really there from the start. And I think, I mean, and like you said, hey, Shelley's got a great eye too. Mark Doyle's got a great eye. I mean,
and Will, Will Dennis, and
I will speak out of school and say, I would love to have a conversation with Will Dennis beyond the convention floor, but the powers that be won't let me talk to editors, unfortunately, over at DC. So be it. And that's okay, because then every time I do see Will, I always congratulate
him. Will's awesome, dude. Will is the person. He's like, Will was really the one that told me. He was sort of like, you know, Jock might be available when I was talking to him about artists for Black Mirror. And I was like, you kidding? Because I was like, awesome. I thought he was busy. And he's like, no, he might be. You might want to go find him. And I was like, oh, my God. And he found Raphael for American
great.
Vampire. He was the one that suggested Raphael. And I knew him from Blue Beetle, but I hadn't seen his work in a long time. And so Will is just like, you know, a godfather to me, man. I love that guy to death. But just what I'd say is it's Vertigo is a company full of terrific people, and they are getting a lot of attention from Warner Brothers, and there's a lot of support from them and infrastructure that's there if you go with them, and their contracts are already, you know, again, I think they're very inviting in terms of all of your options in the comic book industry, other independent creators and all of that stuff. Vertigo is it really is a terrific place, and I'm not trying to do PR because I really am like, you know, I promise I'm not shilling. It is just the truth. It's the truth. I have a lot of affection for them and for I'd like to do more stuff with them coming up.
That's excellent. Well, and I also wanted to go back to DC in general and ask you a creative big picture question, because as I said, I really loved what you did with Swamp Thing. It's very apparent on what you were able to do with Batman specifically, though. I mean, everyone always, you know, and rightfully so, congratulates you on the great work with the Joker, and certainly we're going to see that culminate in Endgame. Yeah. For me, it was really the Riddler, and I'm really happy that you were able to put the Riddler in a much higher prominence, and I love it.
Thank
oh yeah,
you,
I think for real, man. I really think you've made him a real threat again, and or maybe even a threat that he never necessarily was outside of what Jim Lee and Lowe, you know, gave us this, a little bit in Hush.
Yeah,
well, but it was more of a surprise, and I think you really showed the calculating side.
Yeah, I wanted to show, and I, you know, he's really the extension of this kind of this person that has this very private ideology that. Looks at people as nothing, that he doesn't see them as anything but sort of evidence of a point he's trying to make, or things to be manipulated towards this point he's trying to make about himself. And, you know, not to equate him with any, not too specifically, but he represents in some ways, I think, this great opponent for Batman in his first thing. And Zero Year is actually the story I'm still proudest of on Batman, even though I know some people love Black Mirror or some like Court of Owls. And I really love those books deeply. I mean, you know, they're like children, so there's not one I really love better than the others. But the one I'm proudest of out of all of them so far is Zero Year, just because it's intensely personal, and it's also the fun was trying to the challenge of making Batman modern and sort of make it personal and modern the way that Frank Miller, in the spirit that Frank Miller did Year One, in the way that you could never touch the hem of that book. And I get it. But that said, if you make it something that's about why you love Batman and what he's done for you in blackest moments, and at the same time make him face off with terrorists and superstorms and gunmen and all of that kind of stuff masked in certain ways, then you've told a good origin. And for me, that was the thing that we were set out to do. And Riddler, for me, in that he's a great first villain because he challenges Batman's great superpower, if he has one, which is he's the greatest detective. And a detective case is just a riddle. It has all of the answers embedded in it somehow. But the same time, he's also like a terrorist or a gunman. I mean, he's someone who sees nothing but his own grievances and his own ideology, and he's merciless in that way to me, you know. And there's something of that in that character in the way we tried to portray him in Zero Year. Not literally, he's not, you know, and there's obviously a huge chasm between him and that in real life, but he represents the fear to me of somebody who comes into your day and has this private hatred and this private grievance, really, and this ideology that you cannot penetrate, that's sort of, you know, someone who comes into your office with a gun that just has something they're furious about that you will not get through to them. And they're just proving a point in their own way to themselves, and they don't care what happens. And that, to me, there's something of that in that crazy plan he has too. So that was part of the goal, was to try and, you know, make him someone that was scary in a way that touches on modern fears, and make the city post-apocalyptic so that it would reflect fear of pandemic, fear of, you know, blackouts and running out of resources and all of that kind of stuff. So it's built into the language, hopefully, of that book, the visual language, like the things that keep me up at night and I'm afraid of, you know, nowadays.
Understood. Well, you know, and I don't blame you for being proud of Zero Year, because honestly, I think it started with Gates of Gotham as well. You found new things to say about the character, and taking nothing away with what's come before. And Zero Year can sit next to Year One and other great and other great Batman origin stories, because I love Black Mirror, but really coming on the main Batman book and your ambitions from the start really impressed me, because it's like, you know, a great Batman run is tough enough, and yet to find new things to say, you know, beyond just being consistent with the character. And I mean, you know, it started with the way that you approach Gotham City in Gates of Gotham. It gave Justin and Jimmy a great place to go with Jonah Hex, I think. And I mean, and that, and just that whole expansion of the mythos and everything was great. And then, you know, everything that you accomplished with, again, the dynamic between the Batman, between Batman and the Joker, also with the family as well, with the entire Bat family, and now culminating in Endgame, because it just seems like you're finding new things to say about a lot of these characters. Have they grown organically in some cases, or were you just like really bubbling with this shit? And it's like, oh man, if they ever let me loose in the DCU, I got this to say about Swamp Thing and the Bat Universe and et cetera.
No, well, I knew I had a Swamp Thing story and I had a Batman story, and that was it. Okay. And I kept pestering Vertigo about Swamp Thing. I was always like, hey, is Swamp Thing going to come back? Is Swamp Thing going to come back? And then one day I was at home. I was in my kitchen where I am now. And I was making dinner for my family, for my kids. I was making burgers. And I got a call from Jeff Johns. And I did not know Jeff at that time, barely at all. Okay. I had maybe spoken to him a few times, very briefly. And so I was like, honey, can you take over with these burgers? It's Jeff Johns. And I was like very nervous, you know, and I was like, and now we're friends. Like, it's, you know, it's different. But back then I was like terrified of him. And you know, so it's like, and he was like, hey man, I hear, you know, I hear you're really into Swamp Thing and you have like a Swamp Thing pitch. And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, I do. And he's like, why don't you tell it to me? Cause we're thinking about doing the character. And I was like literally standing here, you know, with a spatula, sort of like, okay, you know, Jeff Johns, I'll pitch you my Swamp Thing thing. And, I did. And I had this also, I had the Court of Owls in my head. From when I was working on Black Mirror, I started to develop this idea, and I was like, you know what?
Yes.
It would be really good to pit Bruce against this. Cause what I was thinking of the whole time I was doing Black Mirror, I thought I'd get a second year with Dick. And I had a second year of that story actually planned, where I had a lot of stuff where he was, James Jr. was going to become this kind of peripheral character in the subplot now that he was captured. And it was going to be more about Dick setting up against his own villains in different ways as Batman. I was really excited about it, but then they, you know, brought back Bruce, which was great too. And, the idea that I started to come up with was, if Gotham changes itself to be a villain to Dick Grayson and to bring his worst fears to life as Batman, because it's this mirror to anyone that tries to be a hero and shows them the things they're most afraid of, well, what's Bruce most afraid of if I'm writing Bruce for the first time? And it became, well, Bruce knows – he thinks he knows Gotham. That was my feeling. And then I was like, well, you grew up in a city. You knew your neighborhood. You know, I grew up in the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And I'm like, you know, you knew which stores would sell, you know, cigarettes or whatever you wanted, you know, under the table. And you knew you could get, you know, firecrackers from this place in Chinatown and fake IDs at Playland up by the arcade up in by Times Square. But what you didn't know is you don't know the lives that are lived there, and especially you don't know the lives that were led there in the past. And this sense of that neighborhood, and we used to love to go down to the South Street Seaport a lot. It's one of the oldest areas, you know, in the city. And that sense of it being haunted by the generations of lives that were lived in these cobblestone streets before yours. And then I was like, well, Batman wouldn't know that. He wouldn't know. He can't know. There's no way. And so what if you turn that against him? What if you turn the city's history against him and make it, weaponize it and turn it into this thing that says, you'll never know me. You know, the city is saying, you'll never know me. You'll have to live with that. And I'm going to show you how well you don't know me by showing you a mystery that's right under your feet in your own bloodline. And you don't know what it, you'll never get an answer to it. And that was sort of the purpose. But then I was like, you know what? I'm going to do that. And then I'm just going to, that's it. That's all I got. I'm going to pack my bags and say, thank God I got to do this Batman story. And if everyone hates me, at least I did it. And I did it the way I wanted and I got out. And so, no, I didn't have anything. That was all I had. And then, cause also Grant was on Batman, you know, and that was
right.
That whole thing was sort of like, I love Grant. And I was just sort of like, you know what? I'm going to let him do what he's going to do. And I'm just going to tell my story, and then they'll probably ask me after that to leave, you know, or I didn't think I'd get fired. I just thought that maybe they'd want, you know, I didn't realize people weren't on books. You know, a lot of people, I didn't think you'd be on it for more than 12 issues. I'd only been on Detective for 11 and they asked me to move. So my feeling was maybe I'll only be on Batman for 12 and then they'll ask me to do a different character and let me see what I think of that character. And so no, and then I started writing Death of the Family, and I was like, you know what? And I started talking to Grant also a lot more when I saw him at San Diego and a bit more. And he was very encouraging, and he started talking more about the feel for the character and making him your own, giving him a birth and giving him a death and knowing he's yours. And he sits in a pantheon of Batman that will always be individuated and never cross each other. And all of these ideas started going, and it was sort of like, you know what? I can make my own Batman. And then I started to toy with the idea of, well, DC really wants an origin. They were saying, we really want an origin. We're going to have somebody say what the origin is for Batman in the New 52 if you don't, really. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to let somebody else do it. And I was like, you know, I have an idea for this story. What if I did an origin story, but it takes place in a post-apocalyptic Gotham, and I just flip year one on its head and do that? And then I realized, if I do that, meaning if I start, then I have to stay on the book and – really, if people will let me, if they like me on the book past zero year and bring it back to the present and start really playing with the mythology. So that's kind of where we are. Meaning for me with Endgame is sort of closing down some things that we've done and closing down certain elements of the status quo and then sort of burning it down to build it up a different way right afterwards in a way that will give it a new feel, a new status, a new... you know, just a bright different configuration, I think, in a way that I think, and not radically, I'm not out to, you know, murder everybody or anything like that. It's just, the goal is to keep it fresh. And I have other stories on Batman I'd like to do where, you know, it's going to become smaller mysteries, but with the secrets in them that build to something, you know, after this and different characters. I want to use different characters than I've gotten to use. And, you know, there's things to say about Bruce, too. Like, what if, I don't know, Endgame is all about, for me, I mean, Endgame is all about his mortality and the thing he doesn't want to look at about himself in that way, you know, and making him look at them in some ways, you know, making him see how small he is in some ways and how insignificant, and what if everything he does doesn't matter, you know, like, and what if he's forced to look at, yes, I'm in my prime, but these are all the different ways that this is going to could end, and it will end one of these ways soon. And once it does, nothing you did will ever matter. It just won't. So all of that, bringing that fear to life for him through the Joker, I think is key. Cause that's what Joker to me is the best villain in the world. Cause he sees what you're most afraid of about yourself. Like the thing that keeps you up at night being like, God, I fucking hope this isn't true about me. Like, I hope I'm not that selfish, or I hope I'm not that stupid, or I hope I'm not that any of it. And he'll be like, oh yeah, you are. Like, let me show you how. And then he'll construct some horrifying, nightmarish way of showing you and laugh at you as you know, go down in flames. And that's just the devil. And so for him to see that in Batman and say, let me show you how fragile you are, because I gave you a chance in Death of the Family. And I started working on this story back then, so it's been in the process for a very long time. I just thought, I actually thought, to be totally frank, I thought it was going to come later. I thought it was going to come after we moved to the West Coast and I would do it somewhere around there. But my feeling was basically, it's Batman 75th. What the hell am I doing? Meaning I had a story for here. I knew what I was going to do here, but I was like, why am I saving this for after the 75th anniversary? It's a 75th anniversary. And if I do it now, it ends in a way that allows me to start with it in a very fresh, different way right after. And that will be a great starting point for June, when all of the, you know, we've moved, the company's moved, mm-hmm. we're all in place, we're trying some new stuff, all of that thing, you know, so that feeling was there. And, but what the story's about, and then I'll stop gabbing about it, was just that, for me, Joker is the character who says essentially, you know, what you do, I serve you by bringing you the worst fear of your heart, and I'll show you what you're afraid of. And if you can overcome that, you know, then it makes you stronger for the next time I try and do something horrible to you. And he believes, I think, in some ways that he and Bruce, or Batman to him, are locked in this battle that's eternal, that makes them bigger than their bodies, and that life itself as a person is meaningless as the Red Hood. That's what he felt too. You know, he says none of it matters. It doesn't mean anything. A bomb could go off on a Tuesday and kill you, or I could walk in with a gun. So let's just celebrate that and invite it and show our lives are meaningless. And then as he sees Batman and he sees him trying to teach people that, yes, your lives matter. Everything, you can be the hero you want to be. And he was like, I will fight him on this epic scale and turn myself into this version of, you know, this villain that's basically, the joke is, by arguing that, you know, our lives are meaningless, I've become something larger than life and meaningful. And that's so funny, you know. And he invited Batman to sort of transcend things with him and say, you know, in Death of the Family, that's what he's saying. He's saying, you forgot who you are. You're supposed to be this eternal Batman, this Bat King, but you're becoming soft and fat, and you're caring about these stupid human people, your Bat family, and you're forgetting your real family over here, who are these symbols, these people that have transformed themselves into the figures of legend to be here with you. And then when he drops Joker off a cliff, now Joker's sort of like, okay, I'm going to show you why you don't mean anything. You know what I mean? Yeah, I should never have played this game with you. And now I'm just going to break all the pieces, you know, and burn the set. Like, we're done. And that's sort of the arc of our Joker, you know?
That's awesome, man. No, it's very intriguing. The first chapter was great. And yeah, it immediately, you know, called upon, like you said, the stuff that you set up in Death of the Family. And now Joker's the ultimate nihilist, it sounds like, and is going to, you know, like you said, show that nothing really matters.
That's what he thinks the greatest joke. That's what he thinks the funniest thing of all is. He thinks the great joke is that you think anything matters, like anything you do. He shows you how absurd it is, like, to think it's all meaningless. That's you know, that's what he's about. At least my version of him. That's what he's always been about, you know. And he's been about sort of saying to Batman, we transcend that, though, because we fight that battle of meaning and meaninglessness on this epic scale. And so the joke is almost on me with that, because, you know, we go beyond our own bodies. But you you've forgotten that. And so I'm going to show you how I'm that bigger thing, and you're nothing. You're just the man. And I'm very proud of it, honestly. Like, there's a lot of things, like, you know, like in issue 15, I think it is, like, we open on a page that's all about Joker. It's just Joker, a splash of him and in the dark. And it's that Bruce saying, he's just a man. Don't be afraid of him. Look into his eyes, you know, and all of that. And in this story, you know, I was planning on doing issue 37, it's reversed. And there's a splash of Bruce in the dark, and he's the opposite of saying, you're more than just a man. You're not just Bruce. You're not 32 and strapped to a table. I won't tell you why he's strapped to a table, but he's like, you know, you're Batman. You're bigger. And it's really a mirror story to that, you know. If that one was like cruel and intimate and vicious in a certain way, that was like, it was still a comedy. It was still him saying, come be happy ever after with me and your villains. Like, come here and forget these stupid people dragging you down, reminding you that you're mortal all the time. This one is meant to be the opposite. This one, he holds his face sadly upside down, you know, when you see him next to his smiling face. So it's like comedy tragedy, you know, he's like,
yeah.
So he's just sort of like, this one, I'm afraid, is not going to have a good ending, he says, you know, and he's just sort of like, you know, so it's a lot of fun. I'm really, really happy with it.
It's exciting, man. And I can tell you and Greg are really psyched about it. And it comes through in the work. And I wasn't able to go to New York Comic Con this year, but I certainly saw some of the video interviews that you did. And the two of you were killing me in a good way. Yeah,
Greg's the best, dude. He's funny because we didn't get along when we were on the book at first at all.
I've heard the stories. And I'm so glad that you guys have become this unified front and everything. So you know, that's a testament to both of you that you're able to find this common ground and build on it and become this amazing team.
Yeah, he really has become like, you know, a family member to me now. Like we're very close. Like we pick cons to do that we can go to together and all that stuff. So we're very, I mean, his wife's close with my wife too. He's just one of the best guys out there.
Batman Eternal. Let me ask about that, because that's a different animal in itself.
Yeah.
And I mean, like that extent, I'm glad you're close with Jeff. I was wondering, because, you know, there's been good weekly events and there's been not so good weekly events. Have you gotten advice from Jeff or anyone else when you were, you know, given this? I mean, I don't even know. Did you come to them and say, hey, let's do a weekly? Did they come to you and say, we want you to run a weekly?
Yeah, no, they did. I didn't go to them for the weekly. They were like,
hey, more work, please.
Yeah, they were like, we want a Batman weekly. And at first I was just like, no way. And then I was like, I wound up talking to James Tynan, who does, you know, the Woods and Mimetic, and he was doing backups on Batman and at the time, and he was doing Red Hood. And I was sort of like, you know, they want to do this weekly, and the only reason I would do it, I think, because I had said no already, and then I went to him and I was like, you know what, the only thing that's really enticing to me about it is that if, you know, it's so big that if we can come up with a story that makes it feel, the challenge is to make it feel like 52 issues is not enough, then I would do it. Meaning if we can pull that off and do a story that goes everywhere in Gotham organically and uses every character we can and is sort of like, this is Gotham. You get to live and breathe in Gotham in a way that's character driven and but has all these tendrils of a plot, but it's one big bombastic machine moving forward towards a huge culmination where it's like, you know, oh my God, what the hell is going to happen next in the series? Then I would do it. And so we sat down and I was like, well, what is the point? If they wanted to call it Batman Eternal, and I was like, well, then the point has to be in some way, not, you know, to dumb it down, but why is Batman Eternal? And then how do you attack that? How do you take it away from him and show to like, you know, completely deconstruct it? And so we figured out who would be good for that, what villains, and then we were like, well, how do we start it? And we just started to have a lot of fun. We were up late talking one night, and it was just like, you know what? I think we have it. And so we went back and we said, well, if we can do this and use all of these characters like Stephanie Brown and everybody, like just, you know, the whole cast of like everything, then we'd like to do it. And they were like, great, go for it. And so then, you know, they recommended a couple people, and we brought in, you know, Tim and Kyle, and it's been great. It just was totally, honestly, it's corny, but I really think there's a lot of ways a wheel could have fallen off the thing. And, you know, because it's we just started writing it way ahead and started drawing it way ahead. And, you know, not to make it sound nepotistic, because it's not. I didn't know Tim Seeley at all from when he signed on, and I didn't know Ray Fox very well at the time either. We were still becoming friends. But they were people that I admired, you know, and admired their work. And we all met and kind of hung out for a weekend. And we were like, you know what? We get along really well. And we all like the story. We figured out who would do what section because of their interests and different things. Ray likes supernatural, you know, Tim likes the bombast stuff and character stuff. And we were just like, you know, we like each other. Let's try it. And it really worked out well. I mean, the working process worked out well. I mean, I'm lucky in the way that I came up with the outline with James. I wrote the first three issues with James. I oversee it. So, you know, I go to the meetings and we talk about the story and I get my hands dirty talking about the story, but I'm really viewing it from 30,000 feet. So all credit, anything you like in that series, all credit goes to those four guys, James, Tim, Kyle and Ray and John for the earlier issues. And anything you don't like, you can blame me. Like, that's fine. But really, those guys, anything you like should really go to them as writers, because I get to, you know, I get to be a part of it and help construct it. But they're the ones in the trenches doing it more. So they deserve, you know, they really deserve credit.
I've talked to Tim about it and a little bit with Kyle, and I'll be talking to James and Ray as time goes on as well. But no, so you're like kind of a creative editor at this point. I mean, like you said, you co-plotted it with James, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, you know, I let them. I don't even want to take that much credit, really. I mean,
okay.
It really was the kind of thing where it was like I wrote a giant document with James that detailed all of the beats of the story, the major beats, meaning for a three issue, but all only for a three issue arc, like for Ray, let's say he's doing an arc in Arkham, right? Only there's probably only two things he really needs to do out of three issues that will drive the plot where we need it to go. So the rest is up to him to construct whatever he wants to do, meaning he could make it a background thing that happens, the plot. Or he can make it the whole, you know, the whole foreground and have the things that need to happen for the bigger plot be the big things in the story. And so what I mean by giving them credit is that whatever they did was their construction, their interests in these characters. And sometimes they made the plot move forward in very loud ways and sometimes in smaller ways. And they focused on other things they really liked, and that was their prerogative. So I focus more on making sure, for example, James comes back from Australia tomorrow, and we're now up to literally the last five issues of the whole series. And so I'm going to meet with him and, you know, make sure that the beats of the final ones are really what we need them to be, and that it ends in a way that sets things up. And so that's kind of how I function, is I'll come in, you know, every few stages and sort of talk where it is and look it over and make sure that it's, you know, it's hitting the things we wanted it to hit. But really, these guys are doing it without me. I mean, they deserve, again, all the credit. And I'm, you know, I always feel bad when people say nice things to me about Eternal, because really I'm like, you know, I am definitely like the absentee parent in that regard, you know? terrible father to that series. But that was always the deal. I mean, just so you understand, that was always the way it was
going to be.
When I signed up, I said, you know, I don't have the bandwidth to do more than write the big outline for what's going to happen, and then to write a few issues and then oversee it and be part of all the meetings and talk, you know, make sure I keep up with it and you know, suggest things story-wise and all that. So that was my deal from go.
Okay. Well, and then I also, I know you've co-written before with Higgins and James, right?
Yep. And I would just say with this one, James really is the showrunner on Eternals.
Okay.
So if I would give extra credit to him in the way that, cause we co-plotted the whole thing, and he's really the one that I think is, he's sort of like, if it's almost like, he's you know, Mark is a terrific editor on the book, but I mean, if you're talking out of us, which is the editor, he's really the one that's sort of the editor, and I'm sort of more like the group editor, the person that's like, let me, you know, if there's a problem, I hear about it and I go in, or if something's going really well, I look at it and make sure, you know, that it's safe, that's terrific. But so he deserves, Tynan is somebody who I think is one of the real unsung heroes, I think, of Gotham right now, between that and some of the stuff that he's been involved in, you know, helping with that's coming up. He's really okay. Definitely someone to look at.
Oh, cool. No, that's great. No, I got to meet him about a year ago when he was in Chicago around Thanksgiving. And then, you know, since then, yeah, we've talked a few times and we keep meaning to get together for a word balloon. So it'll happen. And yeah, Higgins. I love Higgins and I love Tim too. I mean, you know, they're my Chicago boys, and I mean, you know, yeah, they're great guys, and I'm really happy for them. And you know, Higgins had already, you know, established himself in the Batverse, and I'm really glad that Seeley's doing as well as he's doing as well. You know, so that's kind of neat, and Ray as well, absolutely.
No, it's really like nothing but love for those guys. Honestly, I mean, I feel like it makes it sound like there's nobody I dislike in all of comics. I'm always like, oh, there are a couple people, I will say. I won't say who they are. But, I just don't want to give the impression that I'm like, you know, Mr. Hey, everybody's amazing and awesome. But, you know, they are. I don't know. All these guys are. They're great. I love working with them. So
it's great, especially that you are being given the opportunity to tell the stories you want to tell. And have such a great experience, because that doesn't happen for every creator. And that's wonderful that it seems to be happening for you in the mainstream. And I wonder, I mean, you know, obviously I'm glad to hear that, you know, certainly once, you know, things settle in Burbank and whatever the next phase of DC is going to be, that you're still going to be doing Batman stuff. Do you have other ideas for the DC universe? I mean, that you, you know, are hoping for the opportunity to explore?
I do. I mean, one I know I have is I have a big Wonder Woman story in my head. That's
interesting.
About, yeah, it's about 11 issues, 12 issues long. It's like a big arc, like a really, and it has a status for her that's a little different than where she is, where it sets her up a little differently, and it would flow out of the stuff that Brian did. So it's in continuity. Cool. It's just, yes, there was a moment, I'll be honest, when I came off Swamp Thing where I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll do it. And then Superman sort of came along, and I was working on that. And then I was like, maybe I'll do Wonder Woman. And then I was like, there is just no way to do Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman at the same time, even though the opportunity to do those was huge. You know, I mean, meaning, because
wow.
I knew when Brian was coming off, and I would still have been on Superman
finishing
it up. And it was just like, I can't, it's too much. It's just too much, and I wouldn't be doing anyone any, you know, doing justice to the books to do that. So, I'd like to do it at some point, though.
That'd be cool. And I mean, do you have more to say about Superman? You know, in the near future.
No, I have another. I wanted to do another story right after this, but you know, it just became. Do you know what it is?
Schedules.
Well, yeah, and you know what I realized, honestly, and this is like too weird or something, but. Sometimes writing two big superheroes at once, like giant superheroes like that, it can feel duplicative in terms of the muscles that you're using. Like, meaning, like for me, writing witches and Batman is a terrific thing. And American Vampire, it's like a perfect constellation where it's like American Vampire is like propulsive and breakneck pace and funny and over the top horror soapy. Witches is like cold, cruel, deep, dark, personal, slow burn horror. And Batman is Batman. It's like, you know, the most muscular, crazy, fun stuff you can do that's personal too. But doing Superman and Batman at the same time, I couldn't be happier with Superman. And I'm really, like, honestly, I really can't wait for people to see the last issue. And I'm really, truly, really proud of it. And the thing that I realized once I started it was like, going from Batman to Superman, I'm using the same writing muscles. It's like trying to keep it personal and thoughtful, hopefully, but also, you know, crowd pleasing and big and over the top and fun and all of those things. And I'm not sure I really have it in me to do two giant superheroes at once. You know, it's just not because one of them suffers or I don't like doing them. I love both, but it's it just feels like – it feels a lot like you're just – you're using the same part of your creative brain for both for me, meaning like to do the Wonder Woman story while I'm doing Batman, even though Unchained and Batman are very different, they still have similar priorities. And that's what I mean. It's like a Wonder Woman series to me that I have in mind would have similar priorities to Batman. It would be, you know, it would be as big as I can go in certain ways and, you know, try and be try and be really, you know, just really, really sort of as over the top and, you know, as challenging as possible in that. It's just sort of it is. It's like it's using some of the same muscles is the best way I can describe it, I guess.
I understand what you're saying. Absolutely. No, A-list heroes. I mean, that's the Trinity right there. And you there is an expectation of those three that sets them apart from the rest. And I was more interested if there's I am intrigued by the idea of you doing Wonder Woman, but is there a Doom Patrol story in you or is there Metamorpho or I'm trying to think of any good C-list Silver Age, you know, book Dial H for Hero, Robbie Reed story burning in yours or something of that, you know, in that realm.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely characters. I mean, there's smaller characters that I'd really love to do. Yeah. I mean, it's funny cause I feel like it'd be, yeah. I mean, I should think more like that, honestly. I think what it is that I have so much creator owned that I get to go to for my
– Understood.
So that for superheroes, I lean into the things where it's like, what is my absolute dream superhero, you know? So it's like for Marvel, I think of Captain America would probably be my top. And then – or Spider-Man, cool. I have a story. So it's – I don't think cool. about like – but, you know, another character, like, for example, I love the original Human Torch. It would be like, what if
Me
I
too,
wrote
man.
That? Or what if I wrote, you know – literally like, you know, or Morbius, for example, or those, like they're characters I would love to do, but it'd be hard to make that my one superhero book at this point if I'm doing creator own. So I lean towards the A-list characters at this point, just for that reason, because it's different muscles than I get to flex on my creator own stuff.
Understood. Now, very interesting. Honestly, Scott, and really, I'm glad that the market is reacting as it is to your stuff, both mainstream and your creator-owned stuff.
Thanks, man.
And you know, we've talked so little about American Vampire. Is there anything you want to tip people off in terms of what's coming? And
sure. Well, this arc coming out is honestly, I'm only 3 issues into six, so I can't say it will be my favorite, but it is definitely my favorite that I've done so far with Rafa. We're having the most fun where it's a combination of the space race and Area 51. So it's totally out of control. It's like basically it imagines that this whole second half of the series and second cycle is mm-hmm. about is really about the first monster, about the creature that's responsible for all the mythology and folklore about the devil. It's this terrible, evil kind of this beast that gets buried deep underground a lot of the time, wherever the people that worship it bring it. And it burrows and it makes this cavern for itself so deep that no one can get to it. And that's sort of responsible for the myth of hell. You know, this place underground where these monsters that after you get sucked down there and buried, you know, or taken down there after you die and you're tortured because he sends people out into the world to bite and take people down that transform into his demons, basically. And so it's this ticking clock as to when he's going to come out of the ground and the things that are trying to fight for him and protect him and how we're going to stop him. And he's been buried. He's buried in the Nevada desert. It's one of the reasons why there's all this kind of temptation in Las Vegas and stuff also too, is kind of the fun like origin of Las Vegas in the story. But the idea is he's buried out in the desert and all the tests they did, the nuclear tests around New Mexico and Nevada, they were trying to kill him, you know, and at the time. And now it's too late and he's burrowed too deep and this team, Pearl and Felicia and Skinner and Calvin, it's like all your favorite characters if you read the series, are going to make a last-ditch attempt to go basically break into this base over the place where the burrow began, which is Area 51. Essentially, it's spoilers, but it is. We don't say it's Area 51 until the end, until later, but it is. And they also, meanwhile, have the Russians are spying on us because they know this is going on. So the other thing you have to do is literally go up in a rocket I literally go up in a rocket and manipulate their spy satellite. So it's a total, it's so over the top that it's like, it, and in a way that I think is completely weirdly believable in the series, because it's things like this were going on in a weird way where they were trying to see if they could intercept and satellites, and they were planning missions right around then with Gemini and stuff, where they could see if a rocket could go into orbit and then basically get its location fixed enough that it could meet with something or join with something. So there's all this kind of stuff that was going on at the time in the space program and stuff that's fun, that kind of coincides, you know, that links up with what we would want them to do. So here, so it's it's half, part of it is vampires in space, and part of it is, you know, I just love this series. I really do. It's like, I can go anywhere I want. And Raphael is like the best partner with that, where he's like, because we always said we'd never take them to space. And but we meant, I would qualify that by saying we meant the future space. We never meant the space race. We always meant like, because people would be like, how far are you going to go into the timeline? Are you going to like, maybe it's going to be like vampires in space? And I'd be like, vampires in space, that's so stupid. And then we got here, and I was like, wait, what if we do the space race, you know? And sure. He's like, you know, and then it just was like, of course. And so the issue that's coming out next, it has one of my favorite opening scenes. It's like the, and I'm totally spoiling things, but whatever, the series, it's, you know, it's a small series. So it has a very devoted, I'm very, like, very grateful for its following, you know, and really it's, the people that read the book, it means the world to us. It's funny because people don't remember, like, I've written more of the series than all of Batman and Swamp Thing and all of that combined, you know? So it's like,
what year did you start on American Vampire? 2009?
It was 2009. Yeah. I think it was 2009. Okay. So we've had 34 issues before we took a break. We've had 6 issues since. So 40 plus, we had 2 miniseries that were 5. So we have 50 plus issues at this point. Nice. So yeah, so we're out there, you know. And my feeling is, it opens with these people waiting. They're waiting in the boat for the space capsule to land, and you know, for one of the capsules. And they're in the rafts, like waiting for this. And they're talking about how it's these chimps they send into space and to test this orbit to see if the ship could go in orbit for a long time. And they're waiting for these chimps, Adam and Eve, to come back down, and the thing lands, and they're like, you know, they take the chimps and they give them champagne. Can you believe it? They waste champagne on these chimps, like but they always do it. So let's go get these monkeys, these fucking monkeys, drunk. Open up the hatch, and they open up the hatch, and the monkeys are vampirized for some reason, and they come running out and fucking bite the, you know, people and bite their. You don't know how it's possible, and that's the end of the. And it's like, that's prologue, so it's like. You know, read this arc. It's a lot of fun. I'm really proud.
That's awesome, man. Now, you know, honestly, I love where you've gone from a historical standpoint in American Vampire, and you've been very generous with your time. I would like to. I hope you'll come back, because I'd be thrilled to really go through the arcs of American Vampire with you, because you really do hit a lot of periods in history that I love, and it's in the same way. Oh, absolutely, man. And it honestly. You know, Chaykin focused American Century just on the 50s, but knowing that Area 51 and the space race is figuring into the current arc, it's like, all right, I got to.
Yeah,
I'd be happy to talk about this more.
It's 64. It's 1965. This arc, so it's you know, it's right at that time. So it's
it's one of my favorite periods, man. I mean, I'm a huge NASA junkie, and more so of, you know, the Apollo missions, more so than the shuttle and beyond. I respect them, but, you know, yeah, that was totally the time, man.
Yeah, no, it's there's an elegance to the rockets. You see, it's so just visually, it's so, they're so beautiful the way they go up like that, and they're so, I don't know, there's just something so iconic about them. You know, Raphael is now he's drawing like Skinner in a space helmet, and I'm like, yes. You know,
man,
and the Russians.
I can only imagine what's coming in the 70s for American Vampire. I you know, I mean,
70s is big for us. It's really 1976 is sort of where everything, the bicentennial is kind of where everything really comes to a head for the series in a really, really big way. So there's a couple, there's this arc, and then after, there's this arc, this takes us, you know, through this, like I said, 1965. Then after this arc, there's an arc that's a little more far flung, where the everybody, basically the monsters that are left, realize what they have to do, this terrible thing they have to do if they're really going to try and defeat this thing. And then there's sort of the big arc that takes place when the thing comes out of the ground and the big war happens. So it's it's a lot of fun.
That's cool, man. Excellent. Well, you know, I hope this turns some people on to the current arc and beyond. And yeah, I really appreciate everything you said today about Batman and certainly Witches, which again, 2 issues in, I think is fascinating. When does issue 2 come out?
It comes out November. Hang on, let me just check. I'm terrible with this. I'm always terrible. I'm like, I have to ask Jack. I'm like, wait, when does Witches come out? You know what I mean? And I'm always like, because we're already on issue. You know, we're working on issue 4, and then I just forget like what the release date is. But it's November 19th. So
excellent. Okay, well that's good, and this will be released with plenty of time for people to get ready for 2. Congratulations on 1 selling out.
Thank you.
I imagine a reprint is on its way if it's not already out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, we're going to use the. I think it's the same. It's the cover. It's a cover with a witch hand scratching out the definition of witches.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, I saw that. You know, on what David sent me. So that's awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
No, I'm very really, good. Man. It's always a pleasure, man. I don't. We can't go so long next time in between interviews. I got to say.
Hear it. I appreciate you saying that on the record. Thank you, Ben. And absolutely.
See, it sounded like Scott had fun, especially when he said, let's do it again and let's not wait so long. So that was very sweet of him. And I appreciate that because it was great talking to Scott and really just getting out of the way and letting him spin some stories. Wasn't that interesting stuff? Man, I'll tell you. And I'm really digging Endgame and what's going on in Batman and Witches and the like and American Vampire. It all sounds amazing. So it's wonderful to have this chance to catch up with Scott Snyder on today's Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Again, great deals are going on at InStock Trades. Hurry up because you can get 60% off select DC titles, about 250 DC titles. And that sale is going to end next week on November 16th. You can also get 70% off select IDW titles while supplies last. Dark Horse titles as well, 70% off. 60% off select Marvel titles. Plus, these books this week on sale. You can get Marvel Masterworks, Incredible Hulk, Hardcover Volume 8, 50% off, $34.99. You can get the Avengers Epic Collection trade paperback, 50% off, $17.49. Batman Adventures, you know, don't let the animation style of the art fool you. Some of the best Batman stories of the last 20 or 25 years have come from Batman Adventures. 50% off for trade paperback volume 1, $9.99. You can also get Batman Superman hardcover volume 2, Game Over, Greg Pak, my guy, along with Jay Lee. Beautiful stuff, 42% off, $14.49. You can get Invincible trade paperback volume 20, Friends, 42% off, $9.85. All waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. Check it out. The deals are waiting at InStockTrades.com. Word Balloon is also brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you for your subscription support via Patreon. If you go to wordballoon.com and click on the donate tab, you'll see videos and it'll explain how to donate to Patreon for Word Balloon. If you can spare a dollar a month or more, that's fantastic. If you want to take advantage of other premiums through PayPal, information is there for that as well. And I thank you for your patience and your support because it really helps me out traveling to conventions, getting to meet creators, and providing more content for you each week right here on Word Balloon. Questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me at Facebook under my name, John Suntress, and the Word Balloon Network. Or you can follow me at Twitter under @JohnWordBalloon. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2014.